Was that ant that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh, one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I make music with my friends.
He's got a laptop. There it is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com, but you're not just listening to it there. You're listening to it People for People Radio Network as well. Don't forget the show times for Mad Science is at 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central Time. Not sure what that is on your time. However, that's Saturdays for the Mad Science Show and Sundays for the Knights of the Round Table. Same time, same channel. Anyway, why it is time to get mad science. Mad Science shows live. Woohoo! Yeah. So, you know, there's been a whole lot of researchers out there throughout the history of time. A lot of you know, conspiracies about why it is that, you know, the world hasn't got free energy yet and all this kind of jazz. And, you know, it just boggles my mind. If you paid attention in science class, which I did, then you would understand things just a little bit more differently than, you know, common folks that really didn't care too much about science or whatever. Anyway, I'm going to play something real quick. With this doggone, this is one of the reasons why it gets on my nerves, and this is one of the reasons why that mad science exists. Just listen up with this a little bit.
So, those of you who watched last week's Top 5 might remember I made a passing reference to Henry Ford's hemp car. As an invention, that was years ahead of its time. And it was. But exactly what happened to it? Why are we all not driving around in plastic cars if the technology's existed since the early 1940s? That's just one of the questions we set out to answer in this week's show, the Top 5 Suppressed Inventions of All Time. Some of these stories are well documented as having actually happened. Some are conspiracy theories and works of imagination woven around, well, maybe just a germ of truth. All, though, are astonishing. Four of the items on this week's list are from 20th century North America. This one, well, this one's not. For flexible glass, we have to go all the way back to ancient Rome. The story goes that a craftsman came before the Roman Emperor Tiberius in the 1st century AD. He had with him a drinking bowl made of glass, but not just any glass. He had the Emperor throw the bowl to the floor as hard as he could, but instead of smashing, it merely dented like a soft metal. The craftsman then took out a small hammer and repaired it. The technology was recounted by two roughly contemporary writers, Petronius and Pliny the Elder, who himself doubted the story but acknowledged that it was widely talked about. Later writers picked up on it as well, and the story passed into folklore through the centuries, to the extent that in the 13th century, that's 1200 years after the story supposedly happened, the recipe for flexible glass was included in a treatise on Roman technology. So why, if it existed, didn't it come into widespread use? Well, the story goes that Tiberius, curious as to how the glass worked, asked the unnamed craftsman if anyone else knew how to make it. The craftsman said no, he'd invented it, and he was the only one who knew its secret. Tiberius quickly had him put to death, which is rather unfortunate, covering up the technology for fear that it would become more fashionable and desirable than gold or silver, and therefore ruin the Roman economy. This is supposedly one of the greatest suppressed inventions of all time. In 1941, Ford debuted a car with a steel frame on which sat body panels made of soybean and hemp. The car ran off biofuel, also made from hemp. It was an answer to the world's material problems. Instead of processing steel and transporting it all the way across the country, why not grow a car from fields near the factory instead? The car promised to be cheap, strong, and easy to repair in case of an accident. It weighed 25 to 30% less than a car with steel panels, making it quicker and more efficient. A video released at the time of Ford himself hitting a panel with an axe proved how resilient the mixture was. But then the war came along. Ford's plants, like so many others, switched to wartime mass production, and the plastic car vanished. In fact, even the recipe for the body panel plastic was lost. The prototype itself reportedly destroyed for no obvious reason. But why? Some claim that the technology simply wasn't ready for mass production. Others that Ford's bioplastic had never actually worked at all, so he'd had to make the prototype from polluting coal tar. Some newspapers even reported he couldn't make the plastic set solid, ending up with something akin to a hemp-based whipped cream. But the most common belief, if the internet is anything to go by, is that in the confusion of wartime production, oil and steel companies, alongside other automobile manufacturers worried about Ford's dominance, had the prototype and research destroyed. It's also commonly suggested that major timber producers of the time, namely William Randolph Hearst, who also ran a series of newspapers, and the DuPont family, major investors in nylon, ran campaigns smearing hemp as a suitable industrial product in order to promote their own materials. Negative publicity at the time helped the passing of the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, which made hemp-based products extremely expensive to sell and could have affected Ford's ability to mass-produce the car. Either way, the vehicle never made it to the production line, and it's only in the last few years that we've begun to reassess fiberglass as a mass-market material and the myriad uses of hemp. The world's cities should have a mass-effective public transport system. Cars shouldn't be clogging up our roads. And it's very nearly the way it happened. It's hard to believe these days, but in the 1920s and 30s, the US was a world leader in public transport. Almost every city with a population of, say, 10,000, had a streetcar network. Most small and privately owned, but some thousands of miles long. Only 10% of the population owned cars, because they didn't need them. And this was a problem for auto companies and supporting manufacturers, who had banked on an explosion in automobile use after World War I. So what to do? Accept defeat? Scale back production? Now, they formed two holding companies called National City Lines and Pacific City Lines, with investment from General Motors, the Firestone Tire Company, Standard Oil, Mack Trucks, and many others. They then used these companies to buy up countless streetcar networks, smaller ones at first and then larger and more profitable entities. Once the companies were under their control, the lines were ripped up and fleets of shiny new buses rolled out to replace them. Or indeed, routes were closed down completely, forcing the people of affected areas and new urban sprawl to buy their own personal cars. The companies involved in the conspiracy were taken to court in 1947, accused of trying to create a huge transport monopoly and monopolizing the supply of buses to the new system. They were found innocent on the first count, but guilty on the second, and fined a rather pathetic $5,000. The damage was done, though. Public transport had died a death in most US cities by the 1960s, and the automobile became king. And there it stayed ever since. Stanley Alan Mayer was a man whose invention promised the world. He developed an engine that could run off nothing but water. The theory was that his cells split water back into...
Pause that for a second. The guy can't even get the doggone man's name right. It's Meyer, not Mayer. But listen to this hack job right here.
Oxygen and hydrogen. The hydrogen was then burnt, reforming water. And according to Mayer himself, the electrolysis technique he invented required less energy input than he got out of it. That is, it violated the first and second laws of thermodynamics. That is, it was a perpetual motion machine. Mayer outfitted a dune buggy with his device and went on a massive publicity tour. He reckoned that just 83 litres of water could get the vehicle from LA to New York. Scientific journals laughed the technology off, as they tend to do with most perpetual motion or cold fusion devices. And in 1996, he...
Pause it again, because here's another... He's sitting there calling it perpetual motion and talking about how the scientists laughed it off because, you know, it's a perpetual motion machine. It had nothing to do with perpetual motion, yet these are the kind of hack jobs and discrediting videos that a lot of people have put out throughout the years in order to try to make Stanley Meyer sound like some sort of nut job or a con artist. And, you know, it just blows my doors off that there's a lot of researchers that have actually went through the same exact hassles, from patent offices to people who wanted to either steal their invention or people out there who believe themselves to be so smart they think that, you know, they know what the laws of thermodynamics and so on, you know, really are. It's ridiculous, because the laws of physics, however you want to look at it, if you understand the laws of physics, you can use the laws of physics to your advantage. So it's not violating any laws of thermodynamics to be able to run a car on water if you understand the physics of what water actually is. Water is by far the best fuel out there, regardless of what everybody says who thinks that they're intelligent enough to try to explain the laws of thermodynamics. First off, water is a liquid, so we obviously know in its liquid state it can't be compressed. However, if you take water and you understand physics, then you can heat that water and you can get those molecules moving around to such an extent that you can literally turn that liquid into now what is a gas, which now is compressible. Not only that, they also keep getting the whole process of what Stan Myers was actually doing ridiculously wrong when they try to say that he was using electrolysis to do what it was he was doing, when in fact he had custom injectors and was using the equivalents of radio waves in order to separate the hydrogen and oxygen molecule. So not only can they not get their facts straight, but they do just complete and utter hack job of talking about hydrogen technology and not and completely not understanding what the heck is going on and trying to misquote the laws of thermodynamics. But I'm gonna let this nutcase finish out what he's saying.
He was sued successfully by two investors and accused of fraud by the court. But his invention received cult status in the mainstream media and latterly on the internet, not least because Mayer died suddenly on March 20th, 1998. Allegedly, he was poisoned after having dinner with two Belgian investors. Perhaps the oil industry wasn't ready for a water-powered car and bumped him off. Well, it's a popular opinion. What's more likely, though, is that Mayer died of a brain aneurysm, having never made a real working water engine. He left no detailed blueprints that have been recreated, nor was his creation ever put up for peer review. The legend of it persists, though, and it probably always will.
So he just finally finished it off and tried to say that he never went and made a engine that would run off of water, which he was driving around in the 70s in a dune buggy doing just that, regardless of the fact, you know how he died. His last words were that he was poisoned. But you know, this is why a lot of researchers finally give up. This is one of the main reasons why. It's not the only reason why. Part of it, which is financial. You know, you can't just rush out there and get a patent on things. And it costs a lot of money to have things custom made. If you don't have the technology or the tools to do something, you're at the mercy of trying to hire somebody who can, who does have the tools to do things. So one of the reasons why we don't have free energy is because the mere fact that the people here just don't have the resources that they need in order to use those laws of physics to their advantage and build the equipment to do what it is that they say can be done. Now, I know for a fact, because I've been down this road, I know for a fact how hard it is to build things when you're trying to sort of reinvent the wheel, not necessarily, so to speak. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. The wheel works good for its purpose, but when you want to make it better and you need custom materials or custom things such as bearings that have less friction than, you know, whatever, you're talking precision tooling in order to be able to do that. Not everybody has access to that kind of equipment. But instead of doing the hack jobs on all these different inventors and stealing their ideas from them all the time, if people, you know, average Joes and Janes would come together and support these people. Now, I don't doubt that there was a lawsuit out there on Stan Myers, you know, when they weren't going to get something that they wanted or enough control over it. They wanted their money back or whatever. And so they probably did have a lawsuit on it, but they didn't have anything to do with the fact that his technology is not viable. To this very day, there are people running vehicles on hydrogen. You know, and even the Mythbusters went out and did a hack job on, that's why I despise the Mythbusters, because they went out and did a hack job on hydrogen technology regardless. Basic science says that water is hydrogen and oxygen. And if you understand the physics of what water can do, you could use liquid water as hydraulic fluid. You could use the knowledge of how to boil water. I mean, look at the microwave technology. You can take that microwave and you can send it through the water molecule. Since water is a dipole molecule, it has a north and a south field on it. And you can rock that water molecule back and forth so rapidly that it will literally cook your food. And if you keep on doing it, it will actually boil that water into steam. So what I'm saying about the how the microwave works is no different than what Stan Myers had figured out that he could do. And in reality, years later, after Stan Myers was already doing it, there was another individual out there who was showing that you could burn seawater on demand. And he literally was doing the same exact thing, hitting it with high frequency, high voltage, and it was separating the hydrogen. There's a reason, folks, why they tell you not to throw water on an electrical fire. You think about it. You get a hydrogen explosion. And so, you know, this kind of thing, this is no new concept. You know, you got that one guy was talking about how all the way back in the Roman days that somebody thought it was going to mess with their economy, and so this guy, you know, suddenly gets executed. Well, as far as I'm concerned, there's been a whole lot of alternative energy researchers that have been executed. That's why it's time to get mad. That's why it's time to use mad science and literally go out there and find people like myself and others that are doing research and back them, you know. And obviously, you're going to have to keep an eye on the research, and you're going to have to, you know, make sure that you don't run across scam artists and stuff like that. But if you believe in the physics and you believe in the science of what they're saying, you know, you can't even discount things that, you know, they sort of work, they just don't work completely, but there's something there that is worthy of looking into, and maybe you can use one of the other laws of physics in order to use that to your advantage. There's so many different devices out there, it's hard to keep up with all of them. If you scroll up if you're on a Super chat room and you scroll up, you'll find a button that says Stephen's Resource Page. He's compiled a whole bunch of links to all different types of research, and there's tons and tons of it. But either way, take those bits and pieces and learn what you can from them, and see that, you know, you put this with that and you get something going on. Now I'm working on a generator of my own that is taking basically concepts of everything that I've learned, and I'm going to show people how to use electricity and store electricity differently than the standard model. Now, all of these technologies, they're not all new. A lot of the things could go back to Tesla and all the things that he were doing and other researchers from way back in the day. And I have to ask, where are all these inventors gone? You know, why are all these energy ideas suppressed? You get an idea out there like using hydrogen, and you hear all kinds of stories about why it is oil companies or electric companies are involved in the situation. And that's not a doggone conspiracy. If you're selling oil, why would you want somebody telling somebody there's a better product, a better fuel source to run the same doggone engine? Or even take that engine and make it better so that the doggone engine is more efficient so that you don't need near as much fuel. They don't want you to not use near as much fuel. They want you to use as much fuel as possible so that they can sell that fuel for the highest price available. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes a lot of people up and decide to walk away because, you know, it's just too much hassle. It's too dangerous. It's not profitable. It's hard to get patents. And, you know, the equipment necessary to do a lot of the things that you visualize and know are possible is too doggone expensive. And you can't even get people to want to work for you unless you have a lot of money to give them. They won't take their talents and help you out. I know a lot of people like that. They're really gifted, but they won't do anything unless you pay them. So it makes it harder and harder. And everybody keeps saying, well, are you running your house on it yet? Well, are you kidding me? How am I supposed to run my house on it whenever I can't even get the parts I need to put the doggone thing in a large scale version? You know? And even if I did, you know, how would I fare? Would I fare as well as the rest of the alternative energy researchers out there when somebody decided it was working too good? Would the government be upset because I could damage the economy and, you know, cause a problem for national security or whatever? You know, instead of trying to move towards the green, renewable alternative energies that they really seriously claim that they want all the time, and even all the green freaks out there that say that they're for the environment, they don't back the alternative energy researchers. They spit in their faces. They mock and ridicule them. They say, oh, well, you're trying to build perpetual motion. You're trying to get out more than you put in. It's not possible. The laws of thermodynamics say, and blah, blah. You're violating the laws of physics. This is why you can always tell when somebody doesn't know anything that they're talking about when they start misquoting laws of physics and the laws of thermodynamics. And they think that they sound really intelligent, but in reality, for somebody who really understands what's going on, they, to me, sound like somebody who was put there intentionally to try to discourage, debunk, or, you know, ruin somebody's reputation so that nobody will listen to what this person has to say. Now, if you can't take all these things that you've learned while listening to the Mad Science Show and put them, you know, all these pieces of the puzzle together, then, you know, I don't know what to say. You know, there's guys out there like Keshi who was running around ripping people off. I mean, hardcore stealing from people, fraudulent, lying, and putting all kinds of crazy stuff on the table. And he got tons of money from all kinds of investors, had disciples that were literally running around and, you know, doing things for him. So anyway, let's move this a little along a little farther here.
And this is perhaps one of the greatest conspiracies of all time, that the inventor Nikola Tesla had the secret to free energy for all and the power to wirelessly transmit it into people's homes, but was the victim of a huge industrial cover-up. The booming electricity companies in the early 20th century couldn't handle his secret, and his one-time backers led by J.P. Morgan deliberately ruined him to keep it from ever being discovered, the evidence later being seized by the FBI upon his death. Now, this is a complicated story, because strictly speaking, it's true, at least technologically. And the FBI did raid his apartment for research papers after his death, but of course they would, because he claimed to be working on laser guns that could bring down an entire air force. Tesla's supposed idea was simple. He would harness the power of radiant energy, that is, the electromagnetic spectrum, to both generate electrical power from the natural energy flows in the atmosphere and to transmit it. And the centre of this emergent technology that would revolutionise the world was the Wardenclyffe Tower, built in Shoreham, New York, in 1901. Unfortunately, the tower, which was built to convey the first wireless transatlantic messages, never actually opened. Marconi began broadcasting signals far more efficiently.
All right, so here we go. Now he's doing a hack job on Tesla, which is really ridiculous, and talking about how Marconi was able to transmit. Tesla was trying to do something for the world to try to end all the doggone wars over resources such as oil and coal or whatever. And J.P. Morgan pulled the plug because he couldn't make no money on it. If you're giving the world free energy, and if you don't understand, you know, radio waves, they may not be your version of what free energy is or electricity, but it's still nonetheless the same magnetic waves producing a signal, that you can turn around and you can capture that signal. You can turn it back into data. Plus, you can also store that energy once you capture it. If you understand it, it doesn't matter whether it's at 50 hertz or up in the terahertz range. All of these doggone waves can be stored. If you understand the physics of what's going on in, you know, induction, electrical motors, electricity in general, transformers, if you understand what is happening there, you can take that power and you can get real on-time power, real on-demand real-time, on-demand power from radio waves. And there was a guy that, he was working with Slayer Exciters, Deeds, and he was actually taking and using the same exact concepts that I'm talking about. And he was running electric motors wirelessly from one coil to the next using the Slayer Exciter circuit, because he understood how it worked. Now, you can take that high voltage and you can use it to pressurize capacitor banks, and you can store it. There was the atmospheric group that were pulling electricity right out of the atmosphere, because there's an actual equation out there that says for every 3 feet off the ground, you get 100 volts. So every yard, you get another 100 volts, and so on down the line. So, several hundred feet in the air, you're getting a lot of volts. They were pulling about 9,000 volts out of the whole deal before it was all said and done. Actually had usable stored power. And that was just pulling it out of the air with wires that were hanging from poles at a couple hundred feet in the air. But anyway, if you don't understand how energy travels, then it's easy to be, told that, it's not possible. Stan Myers never called his dune buggy perpetual motion. Idiots out there tried to say he was, had perpetual motion or whatever. But, that's the kind of thing that this guy is basically saying when he's talking about Tesla technology as well.
Than Tesla could in 1903. His attempts to get extra money out of his major backer J.P. Morgan failed, not least because Tesla resorted to insulting him to try and get more cash. And here's where the conspiracy and the confusion begins. See, Tesla's wireless power transmission system, well, it worked. There were loads of demonstrations of him lighting household lamps wirelessly, but the system was inefficient and expensive compared to mass-produced copper cables, and it was very hard to meter who was using what. So in that respect, wireless power probably was suppressed by the electric companies and cable manufacturers of the time. But his radiant energy device? Well, that's what's known today as a radio receiver. Yes, it did work, but the power levels it generated were minuscule. Most of the systems you can buy now, today, which claim to use Tesla's technology to harness free energy for life, need antennas several hundred feet long to do anything more than slowly recharge a smartphone.
That's because the people don't understand the technology, and this guy's an idiot. As far as I'm concerned, he's just a flat-out idiot. I don't know why people make videos like this, but if you think that you understand the laws of physics, and you're out there trying to debunk every single thing out there, saying that it doesn't have enough power, it had way more power than it needed. It was thousands of volts that he was able to produce. Literally lightning on demand. And if you don't understand how to capture that, then you hadn't been paying attention in science class. But nonetheless, with radio waves, you can transmit those radio waves a long distance. And you can use repeaters to copy that signal and send it out again and again and again. We do it. We actually do it. But just because people don't understand that you're using the same exact energy, they think that, it's all about the current watts and amps. I can't even begin to tell you what kind of shenanigans was come about whenever I told everybody I didn't care about current watts and amps. Oh, you got to have that in order to do this and blah, blah. Get your nose out the school book and open your mind, and you'll see what I'm talking about. But regardless, I want to go down that rabbit hole. It just caused all kinds of havoc.
It's not free energy either, because most of it comes from socking great radio transmitters, which require, you guessed it, electricity. In fact, Wardenclyffe was to have been powered by a vast steam-driven generator. It would have worked as a power distributor, but it certainly wouldn't have been free. In theory, with a big enough string of antennas, you could produce a commercial power station harnessing electromagnetic waves in the atmosphere, but it would be enormous, and it wouldn't work very well. And
that's a lie. That's a bold-faced lie. They already got wireless charging systems all over the place now. You got them for your smartphones and stuff like that. You got them for your little Wii systems, your little controllers. And so wireless technology is already proven technology. And wireless charging's already proven technology. And as far as the efficiency and stuff like that, you hook that same exact system up to basically any type of transistor system that'll switch that power on and off. You can use solar power, you can use wind power to run this thing even when the generator isn't running at all. So there, you know, if you take one concept by itself, you can say all the crud you want about it and try to say that it will not work, but then you're just being intellectually dishonest, and that's what a lot of these jerks like this are. They're intellectually dishonest. The governments are intellectually dishonest. And maybe the government itself, the senators, the congressmen, maybe they don't know. Maybe their education level, as far as, we just trust the scientists. We just trust the electricians. We just trust the mechanic. Yeah, how many people have been screwed because they trusted the mechanic? How many people have been screwed because they trusted the power company? Or the oil company, for that matter? Oh, if they had that they would already be doing it. That kind of stuff. They got you so indoctrinated and dumbed down that you can't take and figure out by yourself that there are people out there who have already done it, who are doing it and trying to get the technology out there to the people. But every time, at every step in the way, you got the entities out there that are making you sound stupid. I showed everybody on YouTube what kind of, you type in free energy or alternative energy or green energy, and doggone, you come up with tons and tons and tons of bogus free energy videos that make a mockery out of anything energy related. And so this is why it's time to get mad. This is why mad science is so important, because the people out there who know it's possible, they give up. They just flat out give up. Why go through all the hassle? Why keep on trying? It's too doggone expensive to build things. Look at what I did, my neodymium magnet accelerator, and I wanted a customized tube bent for it. You know, not only did they do a terrible job at it, it's not smooth. It only functioned partially the way that I wanted, but it cost me several hundred dollars just for two tubes to be made. And so if I can't get the things made that I need, and they're not precision and they're not smooth, I can show a basic concept, but then I'll have those jerks like this one right here going out there poo-pooing the idea. Ooh, are you running your house on it? No, you idiot, I'm not running my house on it. I'm trying to show everybody a proof of concept that if they paid attention to this, it's one of the pieces of the puzzle that could literally give the world what it is that they said they wanted. Don't sit there and talk about carbon emissions and climate change and global warming, climate disruption, if you're not willing to listen to the solution. That's why it's time to get mad. I'm sitting here trying to give the world something for free, and I'm getting spit in my face. Literally. I mean, this is just, it's insane. And I'm just one of so many inventors out there who just like say, what's the point? What's the point? You can't get it patented. You're never going to be able to make any money off of it. Imagine I get one product on the market. Just one. It would fund my research for the rest of my life. And that would benefit everybody. Look what Tesla did. I'm going to play some of what Tesla did here in a minute.
That's the real reason why we don't have unlimited free wireless power transmission today.
No, the real reason why you don't have unlimited free power is because the powers that be, they want to make money off of it. That's it. They want to sell you a glass of water. And chances are you're buying it. You're buying the glass of water because you've been told about your normal tap water being poisoned by the same company you're buying it from regulations that the EPA said it's all right to put fluoride or chlorine in certain people's water. Some places have gotten smart and they don't do that. But, you know, nonetheless, in order to get fresh water, they have to treat it or whatever. You know, it's just crazy. Anyway, let's keep rolling.
Because the fact is, we do. It's just not free or very much power. Well, that's it for this week, and for the moment at least, this
Anyway, I thumb that video down. I don't thumb videos down very often unless they're intellectually dishonest or deceptive or just a flat-out lousy video. Anyway, I don't like it when people try to lie to people or, you know, misquote the laws of physics in order to try to prove a point, you know. But here, listen to this.
He's the protege of Thomas Edison and the man behind our modern world. Welcome to WatchMojo.com, and today we're counting down our picks for the top 10 amazing Nikola Tesla inventions and innovations. For this list, we're not only focusing on Nikola Tesla's inventions, but also on concepts that weren't necessarily invented by him, such as limitless free energy, but innovated through his research and experimentation. Number 10. Directed Energy Weapon, also known as the Peace or Death Ray.
We can make a death ray!
It says no death rays. See?
Oh, man.
We'll never know the exact details of this Tesla innovation because he took the specifics to his grave. What we do know is this. The Serbian-American began working on a laser-like or teleforce beam projector early in the 1900s, with a stream of energy so potent that he expected it to end all wars, hence it being dubbed a death ray by the media. Tesla shopped around the idea and actually wrote an essay titled The Art of Projecting Concentrated Non-Dispersive Energy Through the Natural Media.
LAWS is a system under development that tracks targets and engages them by combining six high-energy lasers into one powerful beam of light.
In the 1980s, the U.S. tested a particle beam weapon as part of a proposed anti-ballistic missile defense system, so it's clear that Tesla's idea was not dismissed.
The test at China Lake was a complete success, locating, tracking, and shooting down five UASs at different ranges.
Number 9. Remote control via radio control. Back in 1898, New Yorkers roamed the streets of Broadway while a strange man played around with some type of apparatus. Crazy? Sure. Brilliant? Yes. That apparatus was a teleautomaton, which was a boat that was remotely controlled through radio signals, and Tesla introduced his invention at none other than Madison Square Gardens. It would be another 50 plus years until the television remote control was developed.
To change channels, press this bar.
However, by that time, Tesla was long gone, and most people didn't care who came up with the next concept. They just wanted life to be easier. Tesla was quite good at helping us out. Number 8. Electric motor via induction motor.
You'll skim off the toughest bit with jet speed.
Well, here's an idea that caught on. At this very moment, you may be fanning yourself off, but not with your own hands, because it's not the olden days, am I right? No, you use an electric fan while Dad works away in the garage with power tools and Mom counts the time on her watch because it's almost time for dinner. What we're saying is this. Tesla is part of your everyday life unless you're living under a rock in the mountains. Although there's nothing wrong with that. Go rocks! Not everybody is lucky enough to enjoy Tesla's innovation today. So remember this man when you open up the refrigerator for another snack. Because if it wasn't for the induction motor that ran on an alternating current that he developed in 1887, we wouldn't have many household appliances, tools, and so on and so forth that we probably take for granted now.
Single-speed drive unit takes Model S all the way up to 130 miles an hour in just one gear.
Number 7. Tesla coil.
The trouble is that the voltages are so huge that Tesla coils, even small ones like this, can also produce lightning.
Perhaps you're familiar with the movies, and perhaps you're familiar with crazy movie scientists? Well, then you're familiar with a Tesla coil, because any legit crazy scientist has many.
Okay, hold on tight and enjoy the show.
Today it's mainly used to entertain kids and moviegoers, and you might have even been lucky enough to personally witness the monster Tesla coil that's on display every year at the Coachella Valley Music Festival, and the one musician Bjork once used as an instrument in the song Thunderbolt, which, needless to say, was not a top 40 hit.
May I, should I, or have
However, when Tesla first invented this electrical resonant transformer, its production of high voltage, low current, high frequency alternating current electricity was incorporated into wireless telegraphy and in medical equipment. Number 6. Robotics.
I want that robot.
We've all heard this line before. Mommy, Daddy, I want a robot. But what it really means is, Mommy, Daddy, I want to pay homage to the great mind of Nikola Tesla. When he introduced his aforementioned boat to a New York City crowd in 1898, you could say that people were a tiny bit agitated, as the concept itself was frightening. But what transpired was the dawn of a new era, a world in which Tesla hoped that actual robots could assist human beings in positive ways. Tesla saw the world through a unique lens, but most of his contemporaries saw something else. That's why Tesla was Tesla, and that's why we now have robots. And as such, he's also been called the father of robotics.
That's 1-0 to the Alte box.
Number 5. Radio.
Incredibile! Funziona! Mamma mia!
With all due respect to the Italian often credited with inventing radio, Guglielmo Marconi, it was Nikola Tesla who first innovated the concept. Unfortunately, when he was preparing to transmit a signal in 1895, his entire lab went up in flames and all was lost. But not the idea, of course. Even so, Marconi was soon all the rage for his invention that Nikola claimed was done with numerous Tesla patents. But in 1943, Tesla was redeemed when the US Supreme Court upheld his original patent. However, this came shortly after his death. Oh well.
Tesla fought Marconi till the day he died in 1943. Same year the Supreme Court ruled that Marconi's patent was invalid, recognizing Tesla as the inventor of the radio. Carter.
You really are sick.
Number 4. Wireless communications. Okay, maybe Tesla didn't invent the idea of free energy, but he did manage to start building a wireless communication tower known as the Wardenclyffe Tower, thanks to the financial support of J.P. Morgan. By displaying the relationship between a transmitter and receiver station, Tesla paved the way for our world of today, where we browse the World Wide Web and send text messages. In 1893, however, it was just another crazy Tesla idea, but you better believe it was an important one.
The energy goes to a distant place, and you will see something like the Aurora Borealis. To conclude, we are coming to great results.
Number 3. X-rays.
The ability to see inside the human body without cutting it open was a turning point in the history of medicine.
If you've ever broken a bone, you've hopefully visited a doctor for a complete exam. This kind of experience can be traced all the way back to 1894, when Tesla began studying radiant energy. But the aforementioned 1895 lab fire destroyed all of his experiments. Months later, German Wilhelm Röntgen discovered X-rays, which led Tesla to build on his theories by incorporating his Tesla coils. And so radiography was born, thanks to the innovations of one Nikola Tesla.
X-rays, throw his car all over, but no, never into somebody's rectum.
You can't get it out? You don't have
to. I'm a physician, but I practice this X-ray only.
Number 2. Fluorescent bulbs.
In this final step, they break the mercury capsules, making the lamps ready to start producing light.
The original fluorescent lamp went on the market in the 1930s, but it came after decades of work from a variety of inventors. One of them was Nikola Tesla, who introduced his electrodeless lamp, or induction light, at the World Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. This occasion marked a split between Tesla and his former mentor, Thomas Edison, who had become known for developing a long-lasting electric light bulb.
I was thrilled to the marrow meeting Edison. This great man had revolutionized the world with his incandescent lamp.
Here's where you'd normally see the honorable mentions, but we've decided that 10 is enough for today. Number 1. Alternating current. It was known as the War of the Currents. On one side, you have Thomas Edison and General Electric promoting DC, meaning direct current electricity. And on the other, you have Tesla's AC, or alternating current, theory backed by Westinghouse. Edison created a culture of fear by showing just how dangerous electricity could be, while Tesla shot it through his entire body. How about that? And it was Tesla's AC motor design that was ultimately adopted in modern times. Tesla invented and innovated many designs over the course of his 86 years, but none of them more essential than alternating current. Do you agree with our list? What is your favorite amazing Nikola Tesla invention or innovation? For more mind-blowing top tens published daily, be sure to subscribe to WatchMojo.com.
Okay, so that was just a fraction of all the different things that Tesla was involved in. But they pretty much tried to write him out of history. They pretty much put him in cartoons and tried to make him seem like a lunatic. And you hear all kinds of crazy stories about him and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's just one tiny example, you know, of a brilliant person that basically, you know, was demonized, so to speak, or, you know, basically attacked, whatever. He's not the only one. He's probably one of the most important, but he's not the only one in history who they've done that to. And it's going to continue, because the power industry out there, they want to stay in power. They want to make money off of what they do. So, you know, let's keep moving.
Best inventions. How far back can we trace their origins? Which inventions have had the biggest impact on our world? And what does the future hold for these amazing devices? Now, great inventions on Modern Marvels. In today's world, technology and invention progress at an astonishing speed. We have instantaneous access to information and images from around the globe. Advances in modern medicine are working to vanquish even the most elusive and deadly of diseases. We can travel great distances in a matter of hours and travel beyond Earth into space. All of this is possible because of humankind's desire and ability to invent. But many of our greatest modern inventions often had humble, ancient origins. Key discoveries that led the way for great inventions to follow. But what makes a great invention?
Great invention has a kind of elegance and a kind of projection. It doesn't solve one problem. It opens up the opportunity to be applied to a variety of problems, and it opens up new opportunities.
One invention that has played a key role in many of society's greatest inventions is also one of history's oldest technological devices, the wheel. Though the exact origins of the wheel as we know it are unknown, it is believed that the combined use of wheel and axle as a device for transport was first seen around 3000 BC in the ancient civilization of Mesopotamia.
What's really important is the wheel, as used on farmers' carts, allows for the movement of crops from the farmlands into the cities, and the more efficient that you can move crops and foodstuffs in from the farmlands into the cities, the bigger the population you can have.
But the wheel had even more ancient uses. With the discovery of rotary motion as early as 8000 BC, enterprising inventors of times long past found the wheel to be an important and versatile tool. They began using forms of the wheel to aid in their everyday tasks. Flywheels and pulleys allowed for heavy stones and rock to be lifted, allowing cities to rise up quicker, higher, and more efficiently. Water wheels became a primary source for generating early forms of power. And rotating gears became the essential device in an endless variety of tools and machinery, helping to spark the Industrial Revolution. The wheel and rotary motion made the creation of another civilization-changing invention possible, the steam engine. The steam engine propelled the world into a new age of transportation. Popular legend has it that 18th century inventor James Watt discovered the power of steam when he observed the lifting lid of a kettle of boiling water. The truth is that man had been aware of the power of steam for countless centuries, long before Watt ever sat down for his first cup of tea.
As early as 100 AD, ancient writings told of a rotating steam turbine wheel created by Hero of Alexandria. The device was described simply as a sphere of Aeolus, but Hero never realized the potential uses of his creation and dismissed it as nothing more than a simple toy to keep a drowsy emperor awake. It would be nearly 2,000 years before a practical steam engine would be invented.
The steam engine was originally conceived to pump water out of very deep mines, and it soon became applied to lots of other things, especially for driving all sorts of mills.
Most closely associated with the creation of the steam engine is 18th century English engineer and inventor Thomas Newcomen. Newcomen designed and built one of the first practical atmospheric steam engines around 1712. The steam engine consisted of a series of steam-driven piston rods linked by chains that rose and fell in order to lift water out of mines. For over 50 years, Newcomen's steam engine set the standard, but a Scottish instrument maker and engineer, James Watt, set out to improve on Newcomen's creation.
Initially, rotative motion wasn't used with atmospheric engines because they weren't very evenly running engines. James Watt, by applying steam to both sides of the piston and a cylinder, and with the use of properly designed valves, could impart a regular rocking motion to a beam and by means of a crank, then rotate a wheel.
This improved steam engine, aided by the wheel, provided a major advance in the way we traveled over water. By the late 1700s, the steamship was man's first major development at traveling great distances since the creation of the sail, thousands of years before. The French were the steamship's earliest pioneers in the late 1700s, but it was an American, Robert Fulton, who first achieved commercial success when he gained worldwide attention for driving his steamship, the Clermont, between New York and Albany in 1807. With the success of steam travel on the waterways, inventors looked at the steam engine as a source of power for land transport. The steam engine led to another revolutionary invention that literally connected communities the world over, the railroad. The powerful steam locomotives created in the early 1800s represented an unprecedented leap over early forms of railroads.
At first, the railroads would not have been steam-powered. They would have been animal-powered. Animals were used to pull strings on cars on rails. But those early developments of steam power made it more efficient to pull heavier loads further distances.
In the 1860s, America was literally tied together with the building of the Transcontinental Railroad from Nebraska to the golden yet isolated land of promise, California. The use of the steam engine helped steel-wheeled railroads become an increasingly powerful force in the growth and development of cities around the world. Railways soon became the world's dominant mode of freight, shipping, or transportation.
One of the things that the railroad did was give people mobility that they'd never had before, allowed them to travel long distances.
By the late 1800s, steam power ruled transport, but inventors began looking for alternative, more efficient means of transportation. The result was one of the most pervasive and important inventions in history, an invention that would soon dominate the transportation industry, the automobile. The early automobiles originally used the steam engine as their main source of power, but they were slow, cumbersome, and fairly uncomfortable for the passengers forced to sit close to the steamy hot boiler. The very first automobile is generally credited to 18th century French inventor Nicolas Joseph Cugnot. His vehicle was financed by the French government and was originally designed as a steam-propelled three-wheeled artillery wagon. With a top speed of 2 miles per hour, the vehicle ran out of control during a demonstration and crashed into a wall. But it is 1880s German inventor and automaker Carl Benz who is generally credited as the father of the automobile.
Carl Benz and his contemporary Gottlieb Daimler are important because they're really the first people to not only come up with, in their case, gasoline-powered road vehicles, but they persisted at it and eventually developed vehicles that they sold for market.
One man who perhaps more than any other would revolutionize the automobile industry with his gasoline-powered automobiles was Detroit automaker Henry Ford. Ironically, it was an early steam engine that inspired the automotive pioneer.
The first self-powered vehicle that Henry Ford ever saw as a boy was one of these steam traction engines. For Ford, one of these light bulb moments, he saw this thing coming down the road as a young boy, and it affected him profoundly.
By the early 1900s, numerous companies were beginning to make automobiles, but it was Henry Ford who succeeded in bringing the auto to the public.
Ford's great contribution was to really see where the future of the market lay, which turned out to be in cheap cars for the masses. And he developed not only a cheap car, but a very good car, his Model T Ford, and developed the assembly line process for producing it cheaper.
Ford's assembly line concept had been inspired by a somewhat more gruesome counterpart.
The meatpacking industries was often called a disassembly line, where the carcass of an animal moved by on a conveyor and the various meat cutters took pieces out of the animal. The great accomplishment of Ford Motor Company was to take something that was enormously complicated like an automobile and put it on this assembly line method, which required interchanging parts and required all these conveyors and carefully choreographed movement of all these parts and sub-assemblies. Engines and transmissions and rear axles had to be on their own assembly lines before they could all come together for that chassis assembly line.
But it did come together. With the assembly line in full force by the 1920s, the price of the Model T, or Tin Lizzie as it was known, had dropped from $850, a staggering figure for the day, to only $260. By the time the Model T stopped production in 1927, 17 million had rolled off the line.
The automobile is probably the most influential invention of the first half of the 20th century. It had such huge ramifications.
All right, I'm going to pause that for a second. Why am I spending so much time on this specific podcast? It's because it basically shows that there was a time when inventors, they had some pretty much free reign, and people would, benefit from them. You listen to the prices of those cars back in the day. That was pretty doggone cool. That, because of, somebody's ingenuity, being able to take and make an assembly line, that they were able to mass produce all these. Well, in modern day, things are just a little bit different for the inventor, because everything is so doggone expensive. There's so much red tape, so many different things that you have to go through, patents and all this kind of stuff, in order just to get a product on market. And so that's what slows down the modern day inventor. There's just no, with exception of a few out there, nobody who's willing to go the distance and spend, if not 5, 10, 15, 20 years or more, just trying to get a product to market. There's been so many people ripped off, so many ideas stolen from the geniuses who created them or invented them or reinvented, whatever. And that's why it's frustrating to see what's going on in today's day and age. The fuel industry, the power industry, the governments, and all the different companies out there, they got one goal in mind, and that's to make money. And so when I hear the hypocrisy of the government saying we got to reduce our carbon footprint, and the hypocrisy of the so-called green people, the ones that say that we need to save our planet and all this kind of jazz, when the solutions come to the table, and they have been there, the biggest solution is to allow people to think freely and start to try things before they deny it, start building stuff, and to encourage children in school to think outside the box like they used to do back in the old days. If it hadn't have been for people, that inspired Nikola Tesla back in the day, we probably wouldn't be talking right now. We probably wouldn't have a TV or radio or all this wireless technology. it just wouldn't have happened if he hadn't found that inspiration and been allowed to run with it. You know, and then, you know, the money men out there that saw that they could probably make a profit off of it, they were interested in his ideas. You know, in today's day and age, modern day investors will invest in an idea if they believe in it, but, you know, it's kind of hard to get anybody to believe in anything anymore because of all the shenanigans that have to do with alternative energy. Now, you have people out there constantly hollering about how, you know, solar and wind or, you know, hit and miss, you know, you can't get no electricity when the sun ain't out and all this kind of jazz. Well, there are other supplementary systems that you could actually put alongside these that would make it so that no matter what the weather was or whether it was daylight or not, or windy or not, that there was still always power added to the system. And that's one of the things that is really important. And I have showed people in many of my videos of all these different little anomalies that if you take one by itself, you get the wise guys come after and say, well, are you running your house with it? That's not going to run my house. How many watts out? You know, and all this kind of crazy stuff. And they just completely and utterly overlook the possibility that this one little anomaly is important enough that if you add it into a system with other anomalies, that how these things work, then you can get this system to function. I did the Free Thinkers video. Finally, I had to tear the thing down because somebody thought it was a good idea and cut the wire, which destroyed my plan of seeing how long it would run. It ran for several years, and it basically was pulling power from all different directions. And to try to get that through people's head, was almost nearly impossible. It's like pulling teeth. But nonetheless, it ran for several years under all the energy that nature was providing, everything from thermal to, wind power, galvanic actions, radio waves, you name it, and solar. So I put a combination of everything that nature was doing into that system. It even used thermodynamics to the extent where when the sun beats down on this box that was covered in black, it would produce heat inside there. And everybody who understands the physics of heat rises, cold air falls. And so even on a sunny day but not windy day, the turbine would constantly spin because that heat was rising up through the turbine. You can see this in reality if you look at roofs on the top of a house. You see these round turbines up there that are for ventilation of your attic. They'll be turning on days when it's not even windy. And how is that happening? Is because the heat is rising. There's a temperature difference outside as opposed to the temperature inside your doggone attic. And so they're constantly turning. Is that going to run your house? Well, probably by itself, no. But if you use those physics to your advantage, there's so many things that you can add together that will literally give you what it is that you said you want. Forget all the stupid terminology about perpetual motion or over unity or zero point. Forget all that. It's just put in place as a stumbling block to the free thinkers of the world who know that free energy is possible. It exists. You're surrounded in it. You're floating in a sea of free energy. And yet, that phrase in itself gets mocked and ridiculed because people do not understand basic science. They don't understand basic mechanics. They don't understand physics, the same physics that they're trying to quote. They have no understanding of it. And if they did, they wouldn't be out there doing what it is that they're doing. And if the people were serious about climate change and global warming and all the craziness that they put on people trying to, steal money from them and basically false science that they're trying to lie, they're saying they're trying to save the planet, but their actions speak louder than words. All you're trying to do is steal money. You're not trying to fix nothing. If you were trying to fix something, then the solutions are available. You listened to a podcast just now for an hour, quite a long time, for they were inventor after inventor after inventor that continuously kept on making advancements that took us all the way from the wheel, all the way up to the train, to the automobiles, and now we're flying around in the skies. And all this technology that you see every time I see anything in the medical industry that has to do with electricity, I credit that to the work that Nikola Tesla did. And all the other people that came prior to him. They took all the pieces of the puzzle, they put them together, they made things that would literally benefit humanity. Now, no longer is it about benefiting humanity. They don't want to sell you a cure for the common cold because they still want to be able to sell you cold medicine. They don't try to show you how to make your stuff more efficient because they want to sell you more fuel. Whereas they will sit there and say out of one side of their neck, we want more efficient and cleaner running vehicles. They have the technology to do just that, but they do not do it because they want to make money. It's plain and simple. It's the almighty dollar, the ruble, the yen, the euro, or whatever, that is literally running the world that we live in today. And if it were not so, we wouldn't be having this question. Because it would actually we'd be getting things done. We should be so much further advanced than what we are right now.
Shapes the landscape, end up with things like interstate highway system. It results in not the death but the decline of the railroads, which were the great 19th century industry.
The enormous popularity of the automobile would forever alter transportation. And perhaps more than any other device, it is the wheel that helped facilitate the transportation and industrial revolution. There are nearly 300 million cars in the U.S. alone, over 40% of the world's automobile population. Great inventions will return on Modern Marvels. Many key inventions, such as the wheel, were a product of discovery, often accidental, by practical beings looking for solutions to everyday problems. By contrast, the study and harnessing of electricity was a direct result of scientific research. Scientists in ancient Greece learned that if you rubbed amber, or electron in the Greek language, it created a magnetic force that would attract light objects such as feathers. Viewed as a mere amusement, these ancient Greeks had no idea how to harness this force. It was not until roughly 200 years ago that scientists finally began to discover viable methods of harnessing electricity. Perhaps most famous was Benjamin Franklin, who in 1752 flew a kite in the midst of an electrical storm. He first noticed that strands of thread stood on end, as if suspended on a common conductor. When Franklin touched the attached metal key, he received quite an electrical shock. With this jolt, Franklin had proven that electricity was manifested in the clouds in the form of lightning. Franklin wrote in his own publication, Poor Richard's Almanac, that his invention of the lightning rod could secure houses from lightning blasts by directing the powerful bolt of electricity into the grounded metal rod instead of the structure itself. As Franklin's lightning rods appeared on homes across America, an outraged clergy remained vehemently opposed to the invention. They believed that lightning expressed the wrath of God and should not be tampered with. As knowledge of electricity grew, inventors saw that this awesome force could be stored for later use. They developed a groundbreaking energy storage device that would ultimately fuel the communications industry, the battery.
The battery has really an interesting sort of impact on the development of electricity. On one hand, it provides that basic building block that allows for experimentation in telegraphy, in telephony, and even in early wireless telegraph.
But the search for a usable battery was not a new one. There is speculation that a crude form of electrical battery may have appeared in the first century A.D. In 1938, an Austrian scientist working in Baghdad uncovered a small pottery jar with a copper tube and iron rod running down its middle. Testing showed that the battery did emit small electrical charges, but not enough to provide any real source of power. Since it was discovered in what was clearly the house of a magician and medicine man, however, many others dismiss it as nothing more than a simple magic trick used to instill awe, perhaps even fear, in all who saw it. The first authentic battery, as we know it, does not appear until the early 1800s, when Italian inventor Alessandro Volta created the first viable energy storage device.
What it consists of is a pile of plates, and in fact, it's sometimes called a Volta's pile, because it's literally a pile of metal plates alternating copper and nickel, or copper and silver, with an acid in between copper and zinc, another pile. And the bigger pile you make, the more current you can get out of your battery.
Volta's invention of the battery was truly groundbreaking. For the first time in history, the powerful force of electricity could actually be stored and used as a source of energy. In the middle of the 19th century, minor improvements were made to the battery. Now, known as wet cells, they basically consisted of a jar of acid with metal electrodes stuck inside. The acid caused a chemical reaction that produced electrons, which flowed through the metal electrodes to provide power to the attached device. Continual improvements were made to the battery. Inventors soon found it to be an indispensable device in their latest life-changing creations. The simple battery became a key element that ultimately fueled major advances in instantaneous communication. Less than 150 years ago, communications were mostly limited to messages delivered in person. As the scientific knowledge grew that electricity could be transferred from one place to another, inventors began to experiment with the possibility that the same principle might apply to communication. The result was a great invention that took the first steps toward bringing the world closer together. Instantaneous communication was now possible for the first time in history with the telegraph.
The telegraph is based on the battery and the electromagnet, both of which are inventions of the very early 19th century. All you have to do to make a telegraph is simply string a wire over a distance, have an electromagnet attached to one end, and have an on-off switch at the other end. And that allows you to send a message. And then when you apply a code, dots and dashes, for example, so that you can represent numbers, letters of the alphabet, that sort of thing, then in fact you can send any message you want over any distance you want that you have the wire to go.
Using his coding system of dots and dashes, American inventor Samuel Morse was the first to successfully send a telegraph message in 1844, with a demonstration line set up between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. The message that Morse sent was a simple but powerful one. What hath God wrought?
The growth of the electromagnetic telegraph was truly dramatic. In only 20 years after Morse had laid his first line between Washington and Baltimore in the mid-1840s, we had people putting in undersea Atlantic cable to transmit messages between the continents.
The battery-powered telegraph gave rise to a whole host of electrical inventions. If the telegraph sent the message that a communications renaissance was on the horizon, then it was one of history's greatest and most influential inventions that actually put it into words, the telephone.
Alexander Graham Bell called it, in fact, a speaking telegraph. Initially, because that's what it was. It was a telegraph line in which you had put a microphone and a speaker, in a sense, at each end, so that, in fact, it would send the spoken voice rather than dots and dashes.
So let's pause this for a second. So, you know, if you listen to them tell all this stuff, and you can see an evolution of how all these inventors had actually, you know, come together to put this entire world that we see today, you know, it's amazing. And I feel like at some point we've all been hindered, you know, by the system in order to not continue those same types of works. The same types of inventive ideas and you know, free thinking that you would seen back in, you know, 1800s and even prior to that, all the way up into the early 1900s. You know, when the people that got greedy about the whole doggone thing decided that you had to certainly start controlling technology. You know, of course, the patent idea, you know, that there killed a whole lot of other stuff as well. But, you know, it's, you know, people want to try to protect their ideas until they actually was able to get them to market and, you know, so that they could benefit, you know, financially from what they've done. But even that doggone system itself has been perverted to the extent where a lot of people are being ripped off of their ideas or denied patents for whatever. You know, if you called anything perpetual motion, that's another reason why that jerk on there talking about how Stan Myers was trying to say his water doom buggy was perpetual motion. You know, if that was the truth, then he would have never got a patent on anything having to do with that water fuel system. And so, you know, because the doggone patent industry, they won't patent anything that claims perpetual motion. But even to that extent, you find something that good, and you get the government's attention, and the system's already set up to we're on the petrodollar, and so our money is basically backed by oil. It's not backed by gold anymore. And so anything that would compete with that would basically be a threat to the system. So obviously they wouldn't want Stan Myers to tell everybody you could run your car on water. And it just totally disregards basic science of what the makeup of water actually is. And so with that said, you know, if you're going to ignore science and you're going to teach people bogus science in school, there's going to come a day when nobody's going to think anything is possible, with the exception of the people, the scientists who work behind the scenes, who make new innovations that they only put out there in the public when it's time for them and to their advantage to become profitable. Otherwise, all these things that we talk about, free energy, there's people in this world that can't even have a light or an air conditioner or a fan or something like that, or heat, you know, whatever. They don't have the luxury of electricity. We're living in the year 2019, getting ready to go into 2020, and there's still people in this world who don't get to have the luxuries of electricity. So, why? Because these are countries that, if they were ever had the opportunity to fully develop, might be a rival system to the system that's in place. Because maybe they want to ensure everybody is equal. Everybody has, you know, everything taken care of. You know, you got free electricity. You don't have no reason to go to war over resources. And maybe they might want to, you know, instead of selling or letting people steal their gold and their silver and their natural resources from them, you know, basically help their people with it. So to end starvation and sickness and all that kind of stuff, you know, if you got all these resources, you should be able to use it. But there are countries that basically from the outside in basically hinder these people. I mean, straight up, not basically, straight up hinder these people from any advancements. And anybody who is innovative nowadays is becomes a target to the system if you've got anything that would rival that system, such as a way to use energy differently than the standard model. Because obviously the people who own the electric company don't want you to have your own generating system. You know, if that were not so, you wouldn't see all these lobbyists out there against solar and wind, and you wouldn't hear all these negative things about them. All of these could be improved on, solar and wind, every one of them, you know. But nonetheless, you try to bring that kind of information to the table and you get the same thing that mad science gets. You know, you get all kinds of crazy people who think they're educated coming out there trolling you and so on. It's mind-blowing how much trouble it is just to try to do what it is that I'm trying to do.
Alexander Graham Bell had discovered that electrical currents could exactly duplicate sound waves transmitting multiple sounds by vibrating in the air in a series of frequencies. Bell was a teacher for the deaf, and he had spent a great deal of time researching sound waves and the principles of acoustics. Working with his assistant, Thomas Watson,
Fell realized that you could not only send several different sound tones over the wire, but that you could actually send one complex sound wave, namely, the human voice.
He realizes it in March of 1876, and he sends the first human message, human voice message over telegraph wire when he says to Watson, "Come here, I want you." And he simply wanted to show Watson that the transmitter was actually working, and Watson heard it on the receiver, and they were very excited.
Ironically, the telephone did not catch on right away. In fact, the leading telecommunications giant at the time, Western Union, refused Bell's offer to sell them the telephone patent for $100,000. Little by little, however, the public began to gravitate to the phone. By 1877, Western Union began to rethink their decision and offered to buy the telephone from Bell and his Bell Telephone Company. But Bell refused. He knew at that point that he had a good thing. Coming up, electricity lights the way for an entertainment and information renaissance. With the invention of the battery, scientists had learned how to harness small amounts of electrical energy. But stronger, more powerful currents of electricity would lead to more great inventions. The advances in electrical power now depended on the development of mechanical methods of generating electricity. Inventors were continually finding new ways to harness this powerful force of nature. One key invention literally ushered the world out of the Dark Ages, turning night into day and affecting virtually every aspect of our daily lives. That simple but life-changing device, the light bulb. The search for a usable light dates back to the 1830s as an alternative to the smoky, dangerous gas and oil lamps that had been used until that time. The principle for the electric light was simple. If you heat something, such as logs, on a fire, the particles will glow and emit light. The problem was figuring out how to control it. By the early 1870s, extremely bright lights that produced an electrical arc between two carbon poles were being used as street lamps, but there was no way to control the luminosity. While there were many inventors around the world working to create a viable light bulb, it was American inventor Thomas Edison who finally succeeded.
Edison is actually a late entrance into the contest for creating a successful light bulb. Edison was already world-renowned for his initial inventions, contributions to the telegraph industry, and the invention of the phonograph. He was already known as the Wizard of Menlo Park.
Edison had boasted that he would have his light bulb completed in only a few months.
Edison, if nothing else, was full of confidence. It took him more like a year and 3 months, but he did indeed produce it. And again, carbon turned out to be the critical substance, and he found that if he had a thin piece of carbon, some trick in getting that thin piece of carbon, and again put the electric current now through the carbon instead of between the carbon poles, through the carbon, you heat that carbon up and it glows. And it glows bright, but not too bright.
I firmly believe that
his inventions, how far back can we trace their origins? Which inventions have had the biggest impact?
And then it's a bunch of people in the 1890s, Marconi, of course, Nikola Tesla, and others who were experimenting in various ways to make this a practical device where you can send a radio wave from here and receive it over here efficiently.
Guglielmo Marconi did exhaustive tests to demonstrate that radio waves would, in fact, inventors were continually finding new ways to harness this powerful force of nature. One key invention literally ushered the world out of the Dark Ages, turning night into day and affecting
thin piece of carbon, and again put the electric current now through the carbon instead of between the carbon poles, through the carbon, you heat that carbon up and it glows, bright but not too bright.
I firmly believe that the machine age will favorably affect the lives of the workers. It is impossible, however, to forecast what electricity and invention will make of the world 100 years hence.
Thomas Edison was right. There was no way he could have predicted the impact that electricity or his own invention of the light bulb would have on history. The invention of the electric light bulb in 1879 profoundly changed society. The visionary inventor also saw beyond the light bulb, and within a year, Edison had laid the groundwork for a complete electric light and power distribution system.
I can't think of anything that changes the way in which we live domestically, at work, or in the community more than the light bulb. Lighting at work allowed for shift work, overnight work, increased the efficiency of laborers. It also made transportation entirely different. The light bulb also changes entertainment. It changes the way in which we advertise materials. It literally changes work, play, and home life dramatically.
With his creation of the light bulb, Edison had also, in effect, created the electronics industry. He had placed his carbon filament electric light inside of a vacuum-sealed, airtight bulb. Over the next couple of decades, an Italian inventor named Marconi took Edison's concept of an electrical property charged in an airtight bulb and developed it into another great invention that would help usher in mass communications, the vacuum tube.
The vacuum tube turns out to be an efficient way of both detecting and producing radio waves.
One of history's most influential and enjoyable inventions would, for the first time ever, bring a world of information and entertainment into the home, radio. When the new concept of radio was introduced early in the 20th century, it created a revolution.
The key element of radio was first an understanding that there were radio waves. This is James Clerk Maxwell in the 1860s, and he describes the elements of non-optical radiation and that this should be available. Heinrich Hertz in the 1880s produces radio waves. And then it's a bunch of people in the 1890s, Marconi, of course, Nikola Tesla, and others who were experimenting in various ways to make this a practical device where you can send a radio wave from here and receive it over here efficiently.
Guglielmo Marconi did exhaustive tests to demonstrate that radio waves would in fact travel through the air. Once a signal such as Morse code or voice transmissions were added, it was discovered that this wireless signal frequency could be transmitted to a receiver.
In the year 1898, Marconi sent his first radio message across the English Channel, a distance of nearly 20 miles.
The implications of this wireless telegraph were enormous. Ships in the middle of the ocean could now send distress signals at the first sign of trouble, a feat previously impossible with the wired telegraph. By the 1920s, the signal sent had progressed from a series of clicks to voice transmissions, causing radio to become a cultural phenomenon.
Around, around she goes.
And sailing is down. Beaten in one round.
With radio, sound could travel over great distances. But now, scientists began to wonder if they might be able to send visual images as well. The result? A miraculous invention that would bring a world of images into our homes, an invention that would literally allow us to view history in the making. Television.
Television is one of those inventions that again has had a profound impact. The addition of visuals to sound really changes the way we, not only the way we look at things, but the way we think about things.
Television technology continues to advance at an astonishing rate. But television of today owes a debt of gratitude to scientists of long ago. In the 1500s, Leonardo da Vinci presented his findings on the persistence of vision, which stated that the human eye continues to see an image for a fraction of a second after it has disappeared. This concept is applied to our modern television system, which sends 30 complete pictures every second. Color television owes a debt of gratitude to Sir Isaac Newton, who in 1666 discovered the color spectrum, proving that a rainbow of colors are formed when white light is shown through a glass prism. In the early 1860s, Giovanni Caselli created what many consider to be the first television broadcast. In an experiment with early imaging, the Italian-born priest wrapped tinfoil around rotating cylinders and sent shadowy transmissions of handwritten messages and line drawings over a telegraph wire. The modern television as we know it was not the product of a single mind, but numerous inventors from around the world who all had a hand in its creation.
Principal inventors often cited for electronic television are Vladimir Zvorkin, who was working first for Westinghouse and then RCA in the 1920s and 30s, and Philo Farnsworth, who was pretty much a lone inventor at the beginning and then got involved with Philco and others. The critical thing here is to take electricity and somehow to detect an image at one end and store this electrically in some form. In this case, it's within a vacuum tube, and then take that information and convey it electrically to the other end, where again some electrical device spews out electrons, and as it turns out, these electrons hit a phosphorus screen and produce an image.
Television took the world by storm. For the first time ever, people were able to actually witness key historic events as they unfolded. By 1936, there were only about 2,000 television sets in use around the world. By 1955, less than 20 years later, television really broke through, with more than 30 million television sets in homes.
As a communication medium, it's become profound. You get to see people land on the moon, which is amazing enough. But it's also had, a fairly significant downside. The television is there, you turn it on, you watch it almost regardless of what's on. And so I think, in fact, we're still working out the long-term implications of what television means to us.
Next, a tiny device cuts years of inventions down to size and opens the door for the modern computer age. By the late 1940s, radio had captured the imagination of the world.
Let's pause this for a second, because getting ready to go into a technology that right now, if you look up motionless energy generator and you check out how this actually functions and so on, we can make solid state versions of generators. I mean, you see it with inverter technology and stuff like that, the way that microwave ovens work in order to be able to modern day microwaves. Well, even the older ones that had digital technology. These new inventions, like transistors, resistors, and all that different types of diodes and stuff, those open the door for tons and tons of more ideas. That, we're watching the electronics world just skyrocket as far as how small they can make things now. And how impressive. But once again, when it gets down to the energy deal, there are limitations put on technologies that have the capability of literally doing amazing things. And so with that said, you find the right combination, you put it together, you take it to market, you try to, try to get it patented and all that kind of stuff. And if it steps on the toes of the people out there in power, then you're going to find that you get a lot of problems. Just let's just say that. Anyway, let's move on.
Television was a new medium just about to explode onto the scene. Of course, these great inventions relied on electricity and bulky, expensive, and unreliable vacuum tubes for their power. Then, in 1948, an invention the size of an average finger was announced with very little fanfare, but it would leave an indelible mark on history and society, the transistor.
The transistor was invented by three men at Bell Labs, John Bardeen, Walter Brattain, and William Shockley. And Bell Laboratories, again, this is part of the AT&T telephone company, they used a lot of information circuits in their own machinery in the phone system, so that's the motive for doing this.
The three men introduced the transistor at a press conference at the Bell Labs headquarters in New York City, but no one paid much attention. Eventually, however, the creators of the transistor were awarded the Nobel Prize as this great invention became recognized as a device that would trigger one of the most sweeping technological revolutions in history. The basic principle of the transistor amplifying electrical signals is simple, but its impact was huge. By releasing a large surge of electrons through the transistor, the weak electrical signal was transformed into a much stronger copy of itself. Transistors increased those electrical signals in a fraction of the space, which in turn scaled everything down to size. Transistors were much less expensive and far more reliable than bulky vacuum tubes. With improvements being made almost immediately, the device played a key role in a great invention that has had a global impact on virtually every aspect of our lives, the computer.
The next significant thing that happened after the transistor was the integrated circuit, a chip. The single thing on your computer that really runs the whole thing, the CPU chip, contains tens of millions of transistors on a single chip. So you can see the economies of scale. We went from 18,000 vacuum tubes to run a big computer down to several thousand transistors to run the first real business computer, down to our desktop, which has tens of millions of little transistors, microscopic transistors, on a single chip.
An extraordinary achievement when you consider that less than 50 years ago, a computer was a massive bank of machines that took up an entire room, held far less memory, and was infinitely slower than today's slowest computers. The earliest forms of computers were created by a mathematician named Blaise Pascal, who actually invented 50 machines in 1645 that would compute mathematical equations. Thinking it to be a great invention, he believed that bookkeepers and accountants would clamor for his new device. Much to his surprise, however, the invention was rejected because the device threatened people who feared it would make their jobs obsolete. He abandoned work on the computers only to turn his fertile mind to other scientific endeavors. But others created early computing systems. By the mid-1800s, a French inventor named Joseph-Marie Jacquard created a predecessor to the punch card system called the Jacquard loom, which automatically manipulated a weaving loom. It is British mathematician Charles Babbage, however, who is known as the father of computing for his work in the 1830s and 40s on a mechanical device most closely resembling today's computers.
Babbage is so significant during this time period is because he formulated what we now know today as the modern computer. There was an input, there was an output, there was a control unit, a processor, all these terms that today are incorporated into the modern computer.
The next big advancement in computing came in 1890 by a young census worker named Herman Hollerith. He created a punch card computing machine to aid in the seemingly impossible census count.
We take a census every 10 years, and it was taking more than 10 years, or they projected it would take more than 10 years to count the results. So clearly that's absurd. The 1880 census had taken 7.5 years, so it was already 7.5 years out of date when they finally got it.
Hollerith's machine was a success and remained in use for several decades. The 1890 census was completed in only 2.5 years. In 1911, Hollerith's successful business machine company merged with another to form the Computing Tabulating Recording Company. In 1924, they changed the name to International Business Machines Corporation, better known as IBM. Computing made its next great leap in the 1940s.
When you think of a modern computer, what you're really thinking of is an automatic digital computer. And the first automatic digital computer was the ENIAC, the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer.
The ENIAC project was funded by the U.S. Army in 1943 as a method of calculating mathematical firing tables for weapons launched during World War II. Previously, with the men off in battle, the complex weapons took a core of 100 female mathematicians more than a month to figure a single firing table.
The ENIAC, I think, really put these massive machines into the public consciousness. People called it a giant brain, and there was this kind of first dawning outside the scientific community of what a computer could really be.
Aided by the creation of the simple transistor, what the computer turned out to be was an indispensable device that has forever changed the way we live and work.
Everybody's using them, and I think that's a very significant thing that's happening in our culture today. In fact, in schools, we've got children teaching adults. I can't think of another time in history where something like that has been true.
Whether editing a simple business letter or influencing the vast global economy, there is perhaps no other invention that has impacted the world as deeply as the computer. Next, 17th century astronomer Galileo is astounded by a device that even to this day continues to save millions of lives.
So let's pause this right here. So anyway, moving right along, we got to the computer age. We got to where we are right now, where we have access to all this information. And there's a war going on out there that keeps this information in line to the extent where, like I said, if you have any idea out there that would rival the system in the energy industry, then you're going to come up against all kinds of craziness. Most generally, you come up against the craziness of the average Joe who believes themselves to be so educated that they misquote the laws of thermodynamics and try to tell you why it is that things are not possible. Oh, if it was possible, they would already be doing it. No, they're not going to already be running cars on water because you need to sell crude oil, right? Why would you want to tell everybody that Stan Myers was right? Why would you want to do that? Never mind the fact that they're already running engines on, you know, on the hydrogen technology. Never mind the fact that the military decided that by 2016 or 2017 or something like that, they were going to start running Navy ships on hydrogen technology. I mean, you can look it up. It's out there. It's not classified secret. But the fact that you'd be running around in a ship with your fuel, driving over the top of your fuel, picking up your fuel as you go, means that you got a whole lot more storage space for other things that you could put on that ship. It's incredible technology. But, you know, when it comes down to putting it in the average Joe's hands, technology that could literally have you a home generator that ran off of hydrogen technology that you could, you know, afford the fuel. I mean, because every time it rains, you could fill your fuel tank up or whatever, you know. And you still have these knuckleheads out there saying, oh, well, the electrolysis process is so inefficient. That's why you don't use the electrolysis process to separate the hydrogen and oxygen. You go back to what Stan Myers was doing and the other character who said he'd sell out to the oil company years later. And not to mention that microwave technology where you can take that water and you can use microwaves to boil that water, you know, turn it into steam. If you had a powerful enough system, you could use electricity to run a steam generation plant, whatever. But you can't think that far outside the box without having all kinds of people come against you, whether they be the average Joe, governments, or you know, lobbyists for fuel industries or whatever. So, you know, I looked up the definition of despise. The definition of despise is to feel contempt or deep repugnance for. And that's what they use that word despise when I talk about environmentalists and government entities that sit there and put out this whole climate change, global warming, climate disruption lie to the public and try to, you know, scare the children into believing we're only got 12 years left of this world, you know, and then whenever you put a solution on the table, they don't want to hear nothing about it. You know, Stan Myers thought, you know, if we could get this, we could stop these wars over oils. Nikola Tesla believed the same thing, that if there was free energy for people, they wouldn't have to worry about all these different entities taking them to war over resources. You know, it just blows my doors off, because if you paid attention in the school of nature, you paid attention in science class, basic mechanics, basic physics, and there's a whole lot more that meets the eye when it comes down to the possibilities of what we could actually accomplish if we were set free to do what it is that we need to do, like the old style inventors that you've been listening, all these people who made the world a better place. You know, and I'm still saying it to this day. That's why mad science exists, because mainstream science dropped the ball. And for those folks out there that, you know, like I said, the highly educated geek that come out of college as an indoctrinated fool, you know, they're the ones that are slowing down. They're the ones responsible for the war. They're the ones responsible for the starvation and the sickness in this world because of their so-called loyalty to the system. You know, hey, hurt me some more, Mr. Government Man, and so on down the line. You know, hey, Mr. Power Company, I'll pay you whatever you want. Just please don't turn my lights off. This is crazy. It's beyond crazy. This is why it's time to get mad. Mad science. This is why it's time to, replace regular science with mad science and go back to what they used to do back in the old days and really invent stuff and put that out there for everybody. You know, it just blows my doors off how many times you can talk about how many things are getting suppressed. How many inventions that you don't hear about anymore that really exist that somebody's either bought up and shelved and so on, and then to turn around and call it a conspiracy, or to make a mockery of somebody like Nikola Tesla who did tons and tons of things that helped our society be able to do what we do today. You know, and the folks that go out there and mock and ridicule all these brilliant minds and inventors, you know, are the same type of folks that are doing it today. They don't want you to have free energy, regardless. They don't want you to even believe free energy is possible. Look at what YouTube does. YouTube promotes fraud. YouTube promotes people getting rich off of lying about free energy. And that lying, when most people realize that these folks out there keep faking all this stuff, it makes everyone look bad. Everyone who's into alternative energy looks bad every time one of those videos is allowed to have 10 ads on it, and people keep on watching it. They get thousands, if not millions, of views, so they're making money hand over fist, while a real YouTube channel that's trying to show people and teach people about energy and solutions and stuff like that, you know, basically gets a couple hundred views a year or whatever. And look it up in the search results. When you type in free energy, you don't see Shaziz, you don't see Stan Myers or John Bedini or any of the other ones like that. You know, if you do, it's somebody out there trying to mock them. And then when you do find one that is good, it's so far down in the ratings, unless you share that video with somebody else, nobody knows. They don't teach it in school. They don't teach about Tesla in school. They don't teach about the truth of everything. They don't teach about how many people's actually been ripped off and stolen from, you know, when they get a good idea. How many people got patents on somebody else's intellectual idea? They don't tell about that stuff. No. You know, and they don't try to promote free thinking. They try to build workers. That's all they do. And so the government indoctrination centers that we call public schools, they're worthless. The colleges are beyond worthless. Colleges are actually scary because they're the ones that teach the people all these things like communism and socialism and every idea that wants them to get out into the street and act like the idiots from Antifa. You know, get out there and burn down their own communities and beat each other up because somebody else has got a different idea than you. That's the kind of craziness. And the green people out there, so-called environmentalists, they're the biggest hypocrites of all. The government, the agents out there, the senators and congressmen that promote global warming, climate change, they're the biggest hypocrites of all. They don't practice what they preach. They're still in driving around in corporate limousines and flying in corporate jets and using all this stuff and living in mansions with a huge carbon footprint while telling you got to reduce yours. They want to charge you higher electric bills for everything. President of the United States, Barack Obama was in here. He says, under my plan, your electric bill will necessarily skyrocket. So he's telling you he's going to screw you over. They're sitting there telling you they're going to do that. So, you know, if you send your kids to the government indoctrination centers and the criminal college system, then you're gonna see more Antifa. Your child probably be the next one in line to go destroy his own community just to give somebody else more power. You know, it's mind blowing. It's flat out mind blowing. You know, where all the good inventors of the past have gone. You know, I know there are just as brilliant minds today that like to think outside the box. I'd like to think myself to be one of them. That's why I say all these things. You know, I don't need to take credit, nor need to get wealthy or anything like that. But people have to have some sort of understanding. The reason why you don't have free energy is because there are people out there that who discourage free thinking, that discourage any idea that could compete with the petrol dollar or the euro or the yen or the ruble or whatever. You know, it's the system that basically wants to sell resources that are actually belonging to all the people and that are willing to go to war for same said resources. Stan Myers, Tesla, John Bedini, all these different people you keep hearing on the Mad Science show about they believe that if they could actually give the world free energy, that it would benefit everybody, from everything from health to education to, you know, not having to go to war anymore for these doggone criminals that we find ourselves at the mercy of following their laws and their regulations. It's mind-blowing. And it's history of all kinds of inventions, all kinds of ingenuity. But these were average people. And some of them called themselves scientists, and some of them didn't call themselves scientists. Some of them just called themselves inventors. But the things that they invented, they helped humanity get to where we are now. And those days are over for the most part because of the suppression. But they don't have to be over. If the average Joe realizes what it is that I've been saying all along, and we bring together our resources and our brilliant minds, there's nothing that we couldn't accomplish. Take all these pieces of the puzzle, build the machines, and put them out there in the public. I mean, you know, nowadays it's you got to show me. That's what they got to see it. They got to have something to touch. You can't just say a concept and have somebody take that idea and use their talents to actually build the thing. No, they're not willing to do that. You can't get nobody to work for free. Most people won't use their gifts and their skills and their tools unless you're willing to pay them a lot of money. And that slows everything down, and that helps the system get even stronger because they have the tools. They have hired the best of the best. And when they hire the best of the best, which is you, they turn around and they monopolize on that by getting patents that they make money on, not you. It's not the person at the college who finds the discovery that makes the money. It's the person who owns the patent afterwards because they put the money up for the idea. And so that's why the people don't have it. That's why the people have lost traction as far as how we were moving forward and the advancements. They'll give you advancements. The system will give you advancements, but only when it benefits them and only when they can financially gain from it. They won't do it unless they have control. And if you get an idea as an individual thinking you're going to bring that idea to market, they'll do to you what they did to all the other brilliant researchers out there. And then The average Joe, the mainstream media, and even the scientists will do everything to say, oh, they're nuts. They were wrong. They don't know. That's pseudoscience. They'll do everything to debunk them, everything to discredit them, everything to discourage people from doing what could be done. And that's why mad science is here. Let's keep rolling.
During an average workday, the human eye must refocus over 20,000 times to read the letters on a computer screen. Modern marvels will return in a moment. Perhaps the greatest advances in modern medicine can be attributed not to surgical techniques or the discovery of new drugs, but another great invention, the microscope. It was not until the invention of the microscope that scientists were able to detect and defeat deadly bacteria. While the practice of healthcare in one form or another is as old as civilization itself, early scientists were truly working in the dark until they began applying the principles of optics and lenses to their research. In 1609, an optician's apprentice discovered that if spectacle lenses were placed in certain positions, objects seen through them appeared to be much closer. Famed inventor and scientist Galileo vastly improved the invention, prompted by this discovery, the telescope. By creating a device that could magnify objects 30 times their normal size, Galileo used the telescope to make numerous important discoveries about our solar system. He soon gazed inward instead of outward with another recently invented optical device that he said made flies look as big as a lamb. That device was the microscope. As man's understanding of optics continued to progress, microscopes became increasingly powerful. Aided by the microscope, scientists would uncover life-saving discoveries that would impact healthcare more deeply than at any time in history. They would wage a war with disease, armed with a powerful new weapon, vaccines. It is only because of the microscope that scientists were ultimately able to save millions of lives with the creation of vaccines.
I mean, a big step forward as far as other vaccines was the microscope and the ability to identify bacteria that were causing diseases, for example, diphtheria. People were able to see specific organisms, and then they were able...
And see, here's another industry that has to do with technology that at one point was a good thing, because vaccines were originally to help people to cure diseases. Now you got guys like Bill Gates out there saying if we do a good job with vaccines, we can bring the population down. And most people miss what he just said. He's talking about basically poisoning people with something that was meant to cure. And there is study after study about how these vaccines have all kinds of health problems that, you know, are harming people. But they were originally designed to help people. Just like everything else out here was originally designed to help people. And then somebody decided, well, we got to get control of this. You got vaccines that work too good, then we ain't going to be able to sell no more drugs. Think about it. And does that sound like a conspiracy theory to you? Or does it sound like conspiracy fact? You be the judge. When people are getting sick from taking something as simple as a flu shot, you have to ask yourself, why? Why? If the vaccine's doing its job, you shouldn't get the flu. But, hey, who am I to say? I'm just a mad science guy, right?
To take them and put them into animals and reproduce diseases and show the same organisms. So the microscope played a major role in the subsequent development of many vaccines.
The earliest recorded attempts to vaccinate against disease dates back to India in 700 AD. Buddhist monks routinely ingested snake venom in the belief that if they were bitten, their bodies would have to build up immunity to the poison. No one knows for certain if that radical attempt at early vaccination was effective, but they did have the right idea. But it was not until the end of the 19th century, with the help of the microscope, that the link between germs, bacteria, and disease was discovered. Scientists began to create appropriate vaccines.
Vaccines are designed to introduce a bit of the disease into the body without actually passing on the disease itself. The body then produces an antibody that creates immunity to the disease in question. Edward Jenner created the first successful immunization in England in 1796. And while he was certainly using an early form of the microscope, his discovery was the result of a keen observation. Smallpox was an epidemic disease that had plagued the world for more than 2,000 years. With a mortality rate of over 40%, scientists were frantically searching for a vaccine to eradicate the deadly disease. Jenner had observed that if milkmaids on farms got an infection from an illness in cows called cowpox, they somehow seemed to be immune to smallpox.
What Jenner did was take the material from the lesion of a milkmaid and inoculated that into the arm of a boy, James Phipps, and that this boy was subsequently exposed on purpose to smallpox and he was protected.
In time, the once deadly disease smallpox was eradicated completely. And then, in the late 1800s, French scientist Louis Pasteur made more great strides in vaccine research.
Pasteur is known to history, I think, primarily because of the nature of the development of his rabies vaccine. And that used the attenuated matter to produce a way of treating rabies, which up until that time, no one had been able to treat.
The next big advancement in medicine was antibiotics. In the early part of the 20th century, one of the most important antibiotics in history came close to being shelved forever. In 1928, penicillin was discovered by Alexander Fleming, who noticed with the help of microscopes that mold growing on a jelly sample in his lab completely destroyed bacteria that he had been cultivating. Ironically, Fleming lost interest in the penicillin discovery, and it was 10 years before another group of scientists uncovered his notes and, realizing its potential, created a form of pure penicillin. With penicillin, great strides were being made in the war on bacteria, but scientists now needed a way to battle viruses. Viruses, unlike bacteria, are a substance much too small to be seen by even the strongest conventional microscopes. Scientists once again harnessed the power of electricity and created the electron microscope, a device that finally allowed the magnification of viruses. America pumped billions of dollars of research money into the development and creation of new vaccines. Jonas Salk's research led to the creation of a vaccine that virtually eradicated the crippling and deadly disease polio, and a host of other vaccines were created to battle diseases ranging from measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis, and many others. These vaccines help us live longer than at any other time in history. History's key inventions have affected and influenced every aspect of our lives, how we live, work, play, and travel. And while these great inventions certainly stand on their own, they are in many ways inextricably connected.
I think what we're seeing in the last 20 or 30 years, the latter part of this decade, is the amount of technologies that are kind of coming together and being utilized together, integrated, if you will, is so dramatic that we are seeing advancements unparalleled in any part of history.
The human race has witnessed an incredible wave of important inventions. As long as man continues to think, he will continue to invent. And the result will be more great inventions that will undoubtedly change the course of history.
So with all that said, why would you want to discourage independent free thinkers from doing what they used to do back in the day? Because if you don't have control of their ideas, then you're not going to be able to benefit financially by their ideas. You don't want somebody else inventing something that they're going to be able to make millions and billions of dollars on if they ever got it to market, because it's going to change the way that you make money. If you show people how to use hydrogen technology and they're able to run their cars on water now, you think about it. Think about that. Now I got to see if I can find the next one in line. Hopefully I Don't hit the wrong one. There we go.
10 famous inventions stolen from other people. 10. The telephone. Alexander Graham Bell is largely credited for inventing the telephone after he secured the patent in 1876. But in 2002, the US Congress declared that the real inventor was actually the poor Italian inventor Antonio Meucci. 16 years before Bell's patent, Meucci had successfully demonstrated his Teletrofono for the Italian-American press in New York. Meucci sent his invention to the Western Union Telegraph Company in 1872 in an attempt to bring his telephone to market. But when no action was taken and he asked for his prototype back 2 years later, Western Union claimed to have lost it. Bell, who had shared a laboratory with Meucci, filed a patent for a telephone and made a lucrative deal with Western Union. Meucci sued Bell for fraud and appeared to be winning the case, but then he died, bringing an end to court proceedings. 9. Radio. Guglielmo Marconi won the Nobel Prize for his pioneering work on long-distance radio transmissions. However, he did so by infringing on numerous patents held by inventor Nikola Tesla. In England, Marconi used Tesla's technology to demonstrate long-distance radio transmissions. Over the following 3 years, Marconi applied for radio patents in America, but was repeatedly rejected as they were too similar to more than 17 that were already held by Tesla. However, as Marconi continued to improve his demonstrations, he received financial backing from powerful investors in the United States. And in 1904, the US Patent Office reversed their previous decision and gave Marconi a patent for the invention of radio. It was not until 1943, a few months after Tesla's death, that the Supreme Court ruled to uphold Tesla's radio patent. 8. Lasers. Gordon Gould is widely credited for the invention of the laser, but it took a 30-year patent war for him to secure this title. As a graduate student at Columbia University, Gould discussed his idea of how to build a laser with physics professor Charles H. Townes. Coining the term laser, Gould wrote down his idea in a notebook, which he legally protected. Meanwhile, 2 years later in 1959, Townes successfully patented the laser, leading to Gould suing. Gould was locked in legal battles for 30 years, securing and defending laser patents. But in 1988, he finally won his last court battle and was able to receive royalties from anyone making lasers, a settlement worth millions. 7. Anyway Up Cup. Amateur inventor Mandy Haberman came up with a new type of cup with a slit valve that prevented spills after seeing a toddler pour juice over a carpet. Haberman patented the valve and showed her cup to big brands in an attempt to sell her product to them. After seeing her invention, children's company Jackal International stole the invention and bought out her cup under the global Tommy Tippy brand. Haberman was forced to take the manufacturing giant Jackal International to court and sue for patent infringement. She eventually won the case, including damages, and is now selling 10 million Anyway Up cups a year. 6. The telescope. The telescope was Galileo's most famous invention, even though he didn't actually invent it. The first person to apply for a patent for the telescope was Dutch eyeglass maker Hans Lippershey in 1608. But the patent was never granted, as the invention was deemed too easy to reproduce. A year later, news of the Dutch perspective glasses had spread to Italy, leading to Galileo engineering his own copy. He improved the magnification of Lippershey's version and was the first to methodically plot the movement of Venus. And he disproved the dominant theory at the time that the Earth was at the center of the universe. 5. Quick release socket wrench. Peter Roberts was 18 years old and working at department store Sears when he invented and patented the quick release socket wrench. Sears bought the patent from Roberts for just $10,000, telling him that his invention wouldn't sell well. It wasn't until Robert saw his wrench in a Sears catalogue he learned that his invention was an enormous success, and that Sears had sold 26 million of his wrenches for a profit of $44 million within just a year. Robert spent 25 years locked in legal battles with Sears, suing them for cheating him out of his rightful royalties. He eventually settled for $8.2 million. 4. Monopoly. Charles Darrow became the first game designer to become a millionaire when he sold the board game Monopoly to toy company the Parker Brothers in 1935. But in reality, the famous board game was patented in 1904 by Lizzie Maggie, under the title The Landlord's Game. Versions of her game were played for 30 years before Darrow took his own version to the Parker Brothers. The Parker Brothers paid Maggie just $500 to buy the patent to the Landlord's Game, while Darrow went on to be hailed as an American innovator. 3. Intermittent windshield wipers. Robert Kearns lost his job, marriage, and even his mental health when his invention was stolen by the big three automakers. His mechanism allowed windshield wipers to pause in between swipes. Kearns showed his invention to Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler in an unsuccessful attempt to license his new technology with them. But despite having more than 30 patents for his invention, all three car manufacturers began to install his mechanism into their cars without his knowledge. Kearns spent 20 years battling car makers in court for patent infringement, eventually winning tens of millions of dollars from Ford and Chrysler. However, he was unable to reclaim his invention, which, by this point, had been adopted by car manufacturers the world over. 2. Brown paper bag machine. Margaret Knight was one of the most famous female inventors of the 19th century and one of the first to secure a patent. While working in a paper bag plant, Knight had the revolutionary idea that paper bags would pack more if they had a flat bottom. So she set about creating a machine to automatically produce them. Initially, she created a working wooden model of her invention, but while developing her metal prototype, machinist Charles Annan stole Knight's design and patented the device himself. Knight sued and was ultimately able to prove that she was the real inventor. Her machine had a huge impact on the paper industry, and the principles behind it are still used to this day. 1. Light bulb. Thomas Edison was a prolific inventor and particularly famous for inventing a light bulb suitable for indoor use. To do this, Edison attempted to improve on British inventor Joseph Swan's version of the light bulb. He secured an American patent for his improvements, and to sell the bulbs, he began a marketing campaign, which stated that he was the real inventor. However, in England, Swan had already improved the light bulb a year earlier. To avoid a possible court battle with Swan, Edison reached out and formed a joint light bulb manufacturing company to release the invention in Britain. Swan allowed Edison to sell the bulbs in America and retain his reputation as the inventor of the light bulb that we still use today.
The music on this video is by our friend and all-time family member, Raddy Ritchie, whose album, You're a Man Now, Boy, is out now.
Alright, so there you go. There's a whole lot of people out there. This is just a tiny little fraction of people who've had their ideas stolen from them, their intellectual property, basically infringed upon, even patents and stuff. And so, why would you want to discourage anyone from, trying to put something on the market, or, you know, use their minds and their talents to make, you know, new designs and make the world better? Who knows, man? Who knows? Does it have anything to do with money? Does it have anything to do with wars over resources? Does it have anything to do with the power structure, the powers that be that want to stay wealthy? Some people would say, oh, well, that's just a conspiracy. They don't suppress nothing. Yeah, okay. Go back to your government indoctrination centers and your criminal college systems. Your education failed.
to another good idea and imagine a machine that could power your house for free. Well, that's exactly what two Australian inventors claim they've developed. Using magnets and a battery, their new generator has been described as revolutionary, and foreign investors are lining up for a piece of the action. Chris Allen reports.
So, John, this is the machine?
Yes, this is it, Chris.
What's it capable of?
Well, it'll power a house. The machine will provide sufficient electricity to run a house and have power to burn.
It sounds too good to be true, but inventor John Christie is convinced his machine will change the world.
So, John, basically you're saying this machine can produce five times as much power as it consumes.
Yes, it does. This one, exactly as we see it, it does. And, in fact, it can produce more than that.
Once kickstarted from a battery, John and his partner Lou Britz say this prototype will run for years without stopping, generating 24 kilowatts of power a day.
You don't get more revolutionary, I think. I mean, we're talking about something that has the capacity to change the way that the world produces its electric power. It has the capacity to change the way that motors, cars are propelled. You can replace the combustion engine, in fact.
John, these are big claims. Are you sure you can live up to them?
We don't really need to live up to them, Chris. The technology speaks for itself.
I mean, a householder could buy one of these machines and install it in his garage and power his house forever without buying another kilowatt from a retailer. I mean, that's how serious it is.
Steve Brassington is an independent electrical engineer. He's seen the machine and backs up everything John says.
It's revolutionary. That's the only way to describe it. I think the technology, it's not bending physics, it's just using principles that I guess are commonly in use in power generation today in a different way. These guys have thought outside of the square.
Basically, it's magnetic attraction and magnetic repulsion that provide the movement or the moment of the motor.
Can you understand why some scientists are sceptical about it?
There is no physicist or engineer who has looked at our motor or has looked at our figures who says it doesn't work.
Lou is an electrician and John a businessman in Cairns in far north Queensland. The two unlikely inventors have been tinkering with their machine for 6 years. They've applied for an international patent and have been swamped by people wanting a piece of the action.
These are the cores. We mentioned the cores don't get hot. Mm-hmm.
Local businessman Alex Romer is one of the many offering money to help develop the generator.
If it proves up to be what they say it is, it certainly would be something I'd invest in.
John has also spoken to millionaire inventor George Lewin, the man who came up with the Triton workbench, and who's now setting up a fund to stop Australian inventions going overseas.
There's an opportunity here, I think, to share an invention with the world that is beyond anything that we've ever contemplated before.
Scientists here at the local university say while they're interested in John's machine, they're also cautious. They say if the machine can generate as much power as John says it can, then they will have to rewrite some of the laws of physics. And they've urged people to be cautious about investing in it until the generator has been independently tested.
Anybody who says it doesn't work hasn't seen it or hasn't looked at our figures. They haven't reviewed it. If they look at it, they'll all agree with us that it does work.
John says the household generator should be available in a year and sell for about $5,000. If he's right, it will make him much more.
And how much do you think your technology could be worth to you?
I have absolutely no idea.
We could be talking about millions of dollars here?
Yes. Very definitely talking millions of dollars, but I'd hesitate to even take a stab at it.
Good idea.
So, that one, they said, would be available in a year. That one, that video itself was from 2013. It's been quite long, quite a whole lot longer than a year. But these people out there, there are real inventions out here. There are real devices out there that actually work, but they disappear so fast. You know, personally, I helped an individual on a generator that I know for a fact works exactly the way he and I said it works, and I haven't heard from him since, so I'm concerned that, you know, there might be foul play. I don't know. you know, maybe he just took a run with it and forgot all about, you know, his friend or whatever. It doesn't matter. It does, but it doesn't. It doesn't matter financially, but it does, because I don't want the technology being shelved. I don't want it being suppressed. And so I keep doing what it is I'm doing. I'm trying to show people things, and if you take all these pieces of the puzzle and you put them together, you'll have exactly what it is the world said that they needed. So this is the last one I'm going to put in here. This is the Motionless Electromagnetic
Generator. Hello, my name is Lee Kenny. I'm the managing director of Magnetic Energy Limited, which is the holding company that was formed by the inventors of the Motionless Electromagnetic Generator, or MEG as we call it, to hold the intellectual property for all of the investments and all of the ventures based on MEG technology. With me today is Steve Patrick, our director of research. What Steve and I would like to do today is to go through all of the steps in the history of the development of the MEG and show you how we arrived at the conclusions that we arrived at and how the MEG has progressed, and then to show you the status of the MEG as it is now and where we need to go in the future. Steve and I, along with the other three inventors, Tom Bearden, Jim Hayes, and Ken Moore, have worked together on this project since 1996. And we're going to take you through that history and then repeat all of the projects that we have done. In 1996, we were visited here in Huntsville by Mr. Kawai, a well-known inventor of magnetic motors and holder of a number of U.S. and Japanese magnetics patents. Mr. Kawai had read all of Tom Bearden's work and was interested in working with us on developing a motor that he had just patented in the U.S. and in Japan. Now, Mr. Kawai did not speak any English at all. He understood a fair amount of English, as most Japanese people do, from having watched American television and American movies. And he could read a certain amount of English. But he hired a translator, a lady from here in Huntsville, to help him with his presentation and to help him discuss things with us. In addition to that, he brought with him these two pieces of metal and these two magnets to help him describe how he was doing switching of flux inside his new motor. So throughout his presentation, he would use these pieces of metal and these two magnets to illustrate his point. And the first point that he illustrated was that when you take a magnet of a known size and you connect it to a piece of metal, and this is just plain magnetic iron, the flux travels down through the end of the magnet, down the first piece of metal, which is acting as a pole piece, and exerts enough force to pick up another piece of metal. If you then take another magnet of similar strength and bring it in close proximity to the first, the lines of flux switch and move up the first keeper bar and across, thereby removing the amount of force that it took to pick up the second bar. And he would repeat this demonstration several times as he would describe and point to different sections of his motor to describe how that section worked. And I'm going to show you this again. The flux is now traveling down the bar and is collecting this bar. And as I bring this other magnet close to it, the bar drops off. Now you'll note, I'm rotating my hands, you note that I have not touched the keeper bar with the second magnet. In fact, it's a fair distance away. Well, as we progress through the day, looking at this and playing with the trick, we began to form some ideas of our own. Later that day, we went to dinner at a Japanese restaurant, and because of the translator, we had at one end of the table Mr. Kawai, the translator, and Tom Bearden. And at the other end of the table, Steve and Jim and I, who were playing with these little magnets. And as we sat there and went through this, and we kept doing this and doing this and doing this, I said to Jim, look, if I could do this without the moving this magnet by some form of electromagnetism, I know that I don't have to put in as much as I've got here because I keep sticking my finger in the middle. And if we wrapped a coil around the bottom of this, I could collect. And Jim said, yeah, you could do that. Steve said, yeah, but you've got a real mess here because you don't have a closed circuit, closed magnetic circuit, and you're going to lose most of what you've got just because you don't have the circuit closed. And we all agreed as how that was true, but that for every time I move this magnet in, or I electrically did a analogous thing, what I would end up with was every time I inserted a pulse, I would get a pulse in, and when I dropped that pulse, I would get a second one. In other words, I would get two outputs for every one input. Well, that sounded like we were going to get something for nothing. So we said we had to go do this. Literally, the first MEG device that we built was this magnet, this bar, with a coil wrapped around it, and a solenoid out of Steve's garage. That was in 1996. We worked on that through 1996 and into 97. And then we came up with the second demonstration, which Steve is going to show you, to prove that in a closed magnetic loop, we could still get the same effect.
Next, we investigated different people who had done some research in magnetic circuits. And we came across a gentleman named Raddus who had worked for Westinghouse. And in the late 50s, he had developed a magnetic switching system to switch magnetic boots for NASA. He had taken this and made it into a latching relay and had several patents on it. And basically what Raddus taught us was that when we have a circuit like this, with a magnet in the center, bar up here and two keeper bars, conventional wisdom, we're taught that you have the same force on both sides, the same amount of flux on both sides. But Raddus showed that that's not true, that this configuration is what's known as a bistable device, where we will have one preferred side, which is strong, and one side that is weak. And it turns out that this is the weak side. Very simple to pull on and off. But this side is very difficult to pull off. Once I've pulled it off this side and replaced it on this side, though, this becomes the strong side. So the device switches the amount of flux from this side to this side. And by Faraday's law, any change in the flux will generate electrical power. So therefore, we looked at how does this work? How much does it go back and forth? And the key to this was Raddus indicated we could do this electrically. We've done it mechanically here. So now I'm going to hook it up and do this electrically, what I've just done mechanically. We're putting a coil on it. And what I'm going to do now is make sure that the side over here is what we call the strong side. Let it hang out. And we just have a small... And as you can see, this is a weak side over here. We have a small battery and a switch. And by merely passing a current through the coil, we have changed the flux from the weak side, the strong side on this side, to the strong side on this side. Next.
This experiment led us to believe that if we could put collection coils on two sides and have two actuator coils, we could then switch back and forth at will.
The next step is to look at generating electrical power utilizing this circuit. And this is basically the same setup we had previously, except now we have two coils for switching and we have two coils for collecting power. And as the device operates, and this, by the way, is the configuration that you will see in the patent, As the device switches, the flux will increase in this coil and decrease in this coil and generate like outputs of opposite polarity. So as the switches, as the circuitry switches from this coil to this coil, we generate power in both sides at the same time.
Another thing that needs to be remembered is that the actuator coil that is not actuated is also acting as a collector coil. So a method has to be devised to remove the connection between this actuator coil and the power supply during the part of the cycle in which that actuator coil is not being used as an actuator, but is being used as a collector. That's what Steve put together in this circuit.
And what you have to remember is that this part of the reason that this hasn't been done before is it's a materials problem. The material has to respond very quickly because we're looking at transients in these coils as the flux changes rapidly to get a very high output. However, it occurs at a very short period of time, in a matter of microseconds. So if we run at a very slow frequency, we have an average output that is very, very low, and it requires a high-frequency operation. The material we've used here, which is called magnetic iron, cannot operate at a high frequency, and that presents a problem to us. Also, it has a characteristic where it doesn't like to change its state, and it will actually generate eddy currents and really eat a lot of power internally to it. What we did here was we set up a circuit board to test our theories. And in this, what we did was we used relays to basically switch between the two coils. The reason we did that was we were able to set the system up so that when this coil was actuated, this coil could actually be switched to a lug and we could measure how much power we could get out of it in addition to the power out of these. This particular board only runs at about 10 hertz, and we get very small outputs because of the losses that are in the material and because of the slow switching speed. However, we were able to show that indeed we do get power out of the coil that is not energized, so that we really have three outputs, and this can be significant later on in our development.
And now Steve will show you the oscilloscope readings that we actually collected when we were running this device with this controller board.
We collect the data from our digital oscilloscopes with a computer and analyze and plot the data using MATLAB or Excel. These are images of Excel plots of the system running at 10 Hz. The top trace is the power measured at the A input coil, and the bottom trace is the power measured at the A output coil. The color shading represents when the input coil is energized, green for side A, tan for side B. The side B data is a mirror image of the side A data. The plots show a long duration between the power pulses. They only occur when the coils are turned on and off. We were able to detect output power in the input coils when they were not powered. The power levels for this system were small because we could not operate the system at frequencies above 10 Hz due to eddy currents and heating of the material.
In the next phase of our development, we moved to a material that was more suitable for switching. The configuration you see here represents the same configuration that you saw with the bars of magnetic iron. However, the material now is a more advanced material. It's called nanocrystalline, and the nanocrystalline material allows you to switch faster and carry more flux than the other material did. We have added output coils, just like the other, and two input coils. These are controlled by an electronic control board that uses a standard switching circuit and drives it through drive transistors. The problem with this system is that we really are not able to extract the power out of the one coil, the input coil that is not turned on, because of the circuitry that we're using. In addition, we have to get a more uniform input of the flux from the magnet into this material. Because it is laminated, it does not as uniformly distribute the flux as the solid material does. So we have to develop new schemes for injecting the magnetic flux in without causing parts of the core to saturate to get significant power out. Now we'll review data plots that show the kind of performance that we can expect from the system in its operation.
Again, the data displayed is for the side A input coil top and the side A output coil on the bottom. Side B is a mirror image of the data shown. Because the nanocrystalline material responds rapidly, we were able to run the system at 31 kHz. The material doesn't absorb significant energy and does not heat. We couldn't directly connect a load to the input coils that we were not activating. However, we were able to place a device called a transsorber across the coil. This allowed us to measure part of the power available in this coil. If we sum the output for both sets of coils and include the power from the input coils that were not energized, we have about two times the amount of power out that was used on the input coils.
Now that you've seen all of the steps that we went through to develop the MEG device to the state that it's in now, let me just point out a couple of things. The time period between this device, which was a 1998 time frame, and this device was a little over 2.5 years. At this stage of the game, we were ready to quit. We had found out exactly what Radis had found out, and you'll see cited in our patent other work done out in California by people who had gotten to this stage and couldn't move any further because of the material. Well, we searched and we looked, and we spent 2 years looking for new material that had the characteristics that we needed. And it wasn't until this nanocrystalline amorphous core material was invented by Allied Signal and then produced in quantity by Honeywell that we were able to move from this stage to this stage. When we got there, we found out that we internally did not have the equipment or the know-how to take this driver circuit and totally reproduce it in an electronic format so that it could be used at the higher speeds. Now, that does not mean that it can't be done or that this is leading-edge technology. It just means we can't do it. We know where we can take this circuit and go to several different companies and literally say, take this and convert it into a full electronic version that we can use at speeds up to 30 to 50 kilohertz. We've also talked to two manufacturers of this material about the injection problem. We know where we can get help to solve that. And we've talked to a third manufacturer that makes ferrite core material, which may in the long run be better for us. So we're at the stage now to where we need to optimize the injection of the magnetic flux into the core material, optimize the size of the collector cores, optimize the circuit pack so that the circuit pack now runs as this one did, but at the speeds appropriate for this. So what you're looking at is we're at the crossroads where right now we're approximately a year and about $8.9 million away from having, I think, one of the greatest advances in technology since Isaac watched the kettle boil. but we can't get there by ourselves. We need a financial partner, just as we know our short suits and where to get help in the technology area. We have some short suits in the international business area that we're looking for our financial partner to fill in as well. Thank you.
All right, so $8.9 billion, and you heard the time frames and all that kind of stuff. But the thing about it is, folks, these folks have been around for a long time. The technology actually exists. The finances necessary to actually put them to where they can actually get the prototypes and everything built are ridiculous. $8 million that he said. If you think about how much money the U.S. gives the United Nations, $50 billion or $50 million, I can't remember which one. Either way, it's well over what these folks would have needed in order to resolve an issue that they said that they had. But you don't see any kind of government agencies offering these folks money to finish this product, to finish this project. You don't see any grants to people for alternative energy. And especially if it says anything to do with free energy, you don't see it. You don't see all these environmental agents, environmentalist people, hypocrites or whatever. You don't see them coming together, throwing their pennies in the bucket to support these researchers. You don't see it. Tom Bearden, John Bedini, Stan Myers, John Searle, all the other, big names that you constantly hear about, even all the way back to Tesla. It all came down to money, how much money you had or who would be willing to invest in it before you could get these technologies out there to the people. So the average Joe is up against a giant, bigger than Goliath, a huge giant. Up against the wall. The wall's, the hurdles are, 200 miles high or whatever. The average Joe don't have the resources and the funds to do things. He said that they knew companies that could do it, but they gotta get to that point where they could actually afford it. That's what I was trying to say earlier. So you don't have people helping these folks out. And you got so many scam artists out there that are trying to basically cheat people to get money and fame and fortune, that the real researchers, they don't get to go anywhere. And then the ones who do manage to pull the resources together, they end up getting ripped off by the system. They end up either getting silenced or suppressed or mocked and ridiculed to the point where they finally just say, enough's enough and give up and walk away. That's the problem. That's why you don't have a free energy device in your house. So take it how you want. Mad Science is here to keep on saying what I've been saying. Keep on doing what I've been doing. Show you the pieces of the puzzle. The anomalies that they were talking about. People have built awesome electric motors with it. The technology that goes into brushless electric motors. And all these different really cool motors that you see in drone technology and RC equipment. Those are because people paid attention to certain anomalies where they were able to get these things to not only be more powerful but more efficient and be able to run on smaller battery packs and so on down the line. So it isn't the fact that we don't have the knowledge on how to do things. We have the knowledge. We have more knowledge than you can shake a stick at. We have more knowledge than you could possibly imagine. We have every single answer to every single question necessary to resolve every single problem under the sun, and somebody out there wants to throw brick walls out in front of us. So all these people out there that think they know it all and they misquote the laws of physics and thermodynamics, all that kind of craziness, all the people that don't understand basic science and basic mechanics or physics for that matter, those are the same folks that after being the trolls and the paid agitators and the people who claim to know it all and the people that do those videos like the one I told you I despise. Because these folks out here, They are basically getting people to the point where they don't even want to try anymore. So I'm going to keep doing what it is that I do because I believe in it and I know that the technology is there. But unless people are willing to share these links to the website and, you know, get in listening on the radio show and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's just what it is. So, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com, and don't forget People for People Radio Network as well. The shows are 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Central Time. Now, so if you're over in, you know, a different country or a different state where you're in a different time zone, you have to look up what Central Time means to you on your side so that you don't miss the show. But the Knights of the Round Table, Mad Science Show, we put all kinds of good information on the table for you, and we got wonderful people to come together that share links and everything. And, you know, we tell the truth. We tell the truth how it is, just how it is, just as we see it, and we're trying to benefit the world one positive pebble at a time. Folks, you've been listening to Mad Science, and hopefully today you learned why it is time to get mad. Why it is time to get mad science. Share these links. That's how you make this work. We got all this technology, and we can't seem to get it out there far enough because there are people that put up walls. Everybody from Google to YouTube to Facebook to Twitter and all that. Unless you're actively sharing this information, then people don't even know we even exist. So with that, I'll say peace and love. Stay tuned for the Music with Kara Hour. And take care, everybody. You've been listening to Mad Science.
Was that that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one hand.
Ooh.
One hand.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one hand.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends.
You got a laptop.
I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with
my friend.
He's got a laptop. There it is. He's got a laptop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office, and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.